husband has just
come
gotten.
home with about 10 caribou. And I was up to my neck cutting it on my kitchen table when this knock come in. I said, come on in. And then I started seeing these blue jackets, caps. And then I looked at old Muktuk Mashton with the National Guard. And behind him was this Lloyd McConnell. I said, Lloyd. And I looked at all these people up here. Look, man, why don't you let me know? Well, you just better be prepared because I brought the governor over to visit you. And I almost fainted. But did you know, as messy as I was, I washed my hands. I was talking just to get in it, but I wanted to get some coffee out. And all we had was this wooden coal stove, you know, and it was going full blast because I was working. And some of my kids had been in school, and the younger ones were asleep. And I made them sit down and told them, well, I'll serve them some tea or coffee. I did. And then yesterday, the day before, I'd made some of this these biscuits. We didn't have any bread factory, or we couldn't go out and buy bread. But we had these baking powder biscuits. And all I had that morning was peanut butter and honey. We had no butter and no cream, but we had sugar. So I laid all that. I hurriedly put the old biscuits and warmed them up in the oven and served them. And when Governor Egan was going out, I thanked him for giving me the honor of visiting my home. And, you know, he turned right around and said, well, may I call you Sadie? I said, yes, everybody calls me that. Well, I think I have the greater honor of visiting the First Lady of this town, and you're very gracious. And it is an honor to have you here and to treat me like I was one of you here. You know, he was the governor. But did you know after they went out, you couldn't touch me with a 10-foot pole?
Well, Sadie, knowing you, I understand very well what he meant.
So that was the greatest compliment any man could ever give me at that time, you know, and to tell me in the mess that I was in.
But you had, what, 10 caribou?
And I had it. And then, too, I decided I was going to make a rack to dry some meat in the house. And I went out and chopped the whole slit the whole board, and whittled it. And all that whittle, that mess on the floor wasn't even swept when they walked in. You can imagine. And then when Nesbitt was Chief Justice, yes, and I was asked to go down there after he had the accident. Well, Egan had been governor, and he was replaced by two others, I guess. I don't remember just which ones, Hickel or Miller.
Yeah, Hickel, and then Hickel went to Washington and Miller.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, anyway, I was called down there to be with the group. You know, giving our respects when he was leaving the office to Chief Justice Nesbitt.
Yes.
And somebody remarked, gee, there's William Egan and his wife coming in. And Judge Sanders, who was my Superior Court Judge from Nome, was there also. I said, did you know William? Oh, only once did I ever met him up there in Barrow. I don't think he can ever recognize me. I was stretching my neck out, and all of a sudden, Bill Egan's hand, Sadie, how are you? And every eye was on me. And he came over and introduced his wife.
Well, where's the credit to Bill Egan? Great.
You know, he had the best memory, I think, of any person I know. And then when we were shaking hands, saying goodbye to Bill Nesbitt, all the times that I've been in his court demonstrating how a native court should be held and so forth under his command, you know.
Yes.
When he was leaving, I felt very sad. And then, we hated to see him go.
I want to ask you, you've got to go, I know.
Oh, well,
let me ask you a question. You say about native court, how native court should be held.
Yeah, well, you know, as magistrates, We were instructed that a man in front of us, a defendant, had to understand his rights. Otherwise, we couldn't put what we were trying to do for him across. Well, there comes this one case when I had my first state trooper. That was Tom Anderson. He was just freshly out of the police academy when he was sent up here. And we knew that was a federal installation up here. But there was someone said there was a crime committed up there, burglary or somebody stealing this and that. And it was a native. He had done it in under influence of alcohol, but the law says that's no excuse. You know, you can't use it. Because I was drunk, I did it. You know, nobody can use that as an excuse. Well, I'm here. Tom Anderson went up there. Trooper Anderson went up there, investigated, and he brought this charge of larceny, which was a misdemeanor. By that time, well, I knew what a felony and a misdemeanor was.
By that time.
Well, anyway, I had no questions. Well, I at that time, I didn't differentiate between a federal and a state charge, you know. It could have been a federal charge. If the people out there at the base had thought to call in to their superiors, their heads. But here, Tom made the charge, the state trooper made the charge, brought this man in for petty larceny. But I found that while I was trying to arraign him, he didn't understand a word of English. So I looked at the trooper, and I said, Trooper Anderson, I'm going to have to translate this whole thing in Eskimo so this defendant may understand his rights. So I read the whole thing in Eskimo. And says, I understand. No, I don't think I need a lawyer. And that's what that paper says is true. I did do it. But do you know, he said, he didn't even call me Judge. He said, Mrs. Nyeho. He said, when I got sober, I took all those things back. And I looked at the state trooper, Trooper Anderson. The defendant states that he, after he sobered up, he returned most of the items that he was charged with. Is this true? And, yes. Well, how much would you say that he was the amount was not listed on the, but it was petty larceny. I know it wasn't over $100. Because it was petty larceny. Well, anyway, he pled guilty to this whole thing. So I proceeded to fine him $25 and have him pay it into the court. He paid it, and everything was all done. So come about 2 weeks later, we didn't have any telephone here in the community, but over at the Ween office building, there's a telephone. A kid comes over to the house and says, you've got a very important call over there that you have to return. So I goes over there, and where do you think it was from? It was from Anchorage. It was from the federal court. Says, Mrs. Nyeho, did you have occasion to have a defendant by the name of Harry so-and-so in your court? Yes. Was he charged? What was he charged with? What was it? Petty larceny. And what was the disposition? Well, after I advised him of his right, he waived his right not to hire a lawyer and pled guilty. And I fined him, sentenced him to pay a fine of $25. Okay, thank you. So I forgot all about it. 2-3 days later, here comes another phone call. And it's from the Supreme Court asking me, would I please come down to Anchorage to demonstrate how I held this court and how I made this defendant to understand what his rights were. And I tried to explain that I translated the whole thing in Eskimo, and therefore I disposed of the case. But what they didn't tell me was there was a difference between a federal and a state charge. So Nesbitt orders me, Chief Justice Nesbitt orders me to go to Anchorage to demonstrate and scare the daylights out of me. But I learned he was a wonderful man. I was escorted right into his office, and there was this man with a white shirt leaning over a table just like this, you know. I walked in, I'm trembling. I go, gee whiz, I wonder what they're going to do to me. Maybe they're going to put me in jail or something. All these things are going through my mind. And he said, Sadie, sit down. it's good to see you. This man, you know, it's you. What am I afraid of? He's a regular human being, you know, the first time I met him. And so what we want you to do is to go in the courthouse and demonstrate. There'll be some listeners in there that speaks your language. What the lawyer wants is to know how you actually arraigned this man, because he cannot. The judge that was trying to handle him is very frustrated because he cannot make the man understand in English. So will you do it? Yeah, I went in there and scared me. Never seen in a big courthouse like that before. But I did. And Lucy and Larry Awakana were living in Anchorage, and they were one of the listeners. And I guess some others who understood our language. Well and done. I go back home, no more problems. From that time on, it's all in order that I can arraign an Eskimo.
Is that what the question was?
Right. Well, he wanted me to demonstrate how I made this defendant understand his right, because the judge, that federal judge, U.S. Marshal, or this judge, couldn't get across to this defendant what he was trying to do in arraignment, because the man didn't speak English.
Of course. All right, now, in this particular, it was a different man, it was a different case. That you
same one, but using it only in a manner of moot court, as you would call it, you know, actually going through the same procedure I did with that same man, where these other court personnel couldn't get across to.
Yes.
But they never pressed any of this, because it would have been double jeopardy.
I see. Now, the the trick of that was that in this case, the judge spoke the language.
Right.
Now, do they have translators now? Do they bring...
I'm the official court translator for Barrow.
For
but if I can't, if there are counsel present and they... object to my being the translator, I have to have a translator.
Yes.
No, other than that, I'm the court's official translator up here.
Uh-huh. I see. Now, and you're federal? State?
I'm state.
You're state, yes.
Uh-huh.
But you do handle federal cases here, don't you?
No.
You don't handle
no,
federal.
Not any federal charges.
I see.
I know that.
Yeah. And they have to go to Fairbanks.
They have to go to the U.S. courts in Anchorage or in Fairbanks.
I see.
Uh-huh.
What are some of the most humorous cases?
What are some of the humorous cases? I'll tell you one that probably knocked you out. I had no state trooper, but there was a report of a burglary at the airport, Wien, cargo room. And so we had a city policeman, just one, a native boy who had never been trained. So when I go up there to investigate this whole thing, I found that the box, some of the boxes had been left with the repack listings of liquor. It was nothing but liquor, you know, freight. And so I picked up the receipts from those boxes, left the boxes there, and brought them in. And I called the city policeman, and now anyone who went through that would, I don't think, has drank all this liquor within 3 hours. So here's the list. And if you find anyone drunk, make sure what type of bottle they're drinking from and bring them in as suspects.
Yes.
And then I'll type the complaint out. You'll sign. Make state offenses. State charge. Burglary not in a dwelling. Well, they're two felonies. So I arraigned and advised as to their rights to a preliminary examination. But I made the bail high enough so that they were to be shipped out the next day. And I didn't know how to drive. So the only vehicle I could get was to call the extension service, University Extension, who had the state vehicles. I called Max Brewer, and Max, it'd be possible for me to borrow a Jeep or something to transport my... We didn't have this airport. So he, all right, provided that somebody who knows how to drive come and pick it up. Or maybe I can have one of my men deliver it to your station, but you're going to have to get your driver. and make sure that your prisoners are in handcuffs when you transport them. All right. All well and good. But do you know that that city policeman was so proud that he took the evidence, the liquor, and got his girlfriend and had a party with that evidence? By 6 in the morning, the guard comes over to my house. Sadie, I need your help. What's happened? I've got your city policeman and his girlfriend up there in the cell. So, what? I go up there, and lo and behold, here's my two felony convicts, you know, sitting out there where the guard is sitting playing guitar and singing away. And my city policeman and his girlfriend are stuck in the same cell. The guard did it, took the prisoners out and stuck the my city policeman and
his girlfriend with it.
I said, where's the Jeep? He says, we don't know. He had it last night. The city policeman. And he was in no shape to tell us. So I called my husband and I told him, Nick, you're going to have to come over and help us. Well, you're going to have to help me find that Jeep that I'm supposed to transport these prisoners out with this morning. And so he comes over. And I said, first take the policeman home. And I'll take the girlfriend home. We separated. So, well and good. And then somebody by that time reported seeing the Jeep stuck in the mud between here and the base. Well, Nate had the track vehicle, the one that you saw outside our house. I said, well, Nate, you're going to have to go out and bring it in. So when he did, I washed it. But it stunk up. Somebody broke a whole bottle of whiskey inside that thing. And it scared me. Gee, what's Max going to say to me? You know, Max Moore? Going to say to me when I return this vehicle. So that morning, when it came plain time for me to transport, I go over to the school and ask the principal of the school if I couldn't borrow one of his maintenance who knew how to drive my two prisoners out. And it was Mr. Gordon. And he says, okay, Sadie, this time I'll let you. But don't take more than an hour. Well, maybe he can use his lunch. When I bring him in, I'll take him over to the house and feed him, and then he can go right to work. Anyway, that's how that one came out. You know, at those times, when you request to transport prisoners out in lieu of bail, a trooper comes in from Fairbanks in civilian clothes, and you're not supposed to recognize them. They're not coming in, you know, conspicuous, no uniform. And I'm there at the airport looking around. See, I wonder when that darn trooper's going to contact me, you know. And I keep looking, and every suspicious person, and no one about right here. I'm sitting with the two prisoners, you know, in handcuffs. And they're two young kids, harmless when they got sober. My two culprits. And by the time I'm getting frustrated, or maybe the trooper didn't come in. And I guess the trooper was doing the same thing. He was beginning to wonder where the prisoners were. Well, then they were quite obvious. They're sitting with their hands behind with handcuffs, you know. And they look innocent. So finally, I go up to the WIN office and said, do you know if a trooper come in on this flight or not? Yes, there's one. Can you point him out to me? I don't know. I can't do that. I don't know what he looks like. Well, finally, I said, well, will the trooper who come in on this flight, please contact Mrs. Nichol. I've got two prisoners for him to transport out of this community. By that time, here comes old Monaco. I could have shot him in civilian clothes. I'd known him for years, but he had his back turned all the time, just playing with me. And later on, when my work, you know, full force, I didn't want to take that kind of stammer. I could have had you in jail for pulling that on me. And I was frustrated. But anyway, nothing came of it, and then my two prisoners went. But come the next day, was my time to question my city policeman. You committed a crime by taking my evidence. Now, I think this case is going to be thrown out because you used up the evidence. And do you know, when this thing came up, there were empty bottles, part of the shipment and the receipt, and the boxes was what saved me. I had marked the bottles. These were the bottles, part of the park. And at the preliminary examination, there was evidence enough to bind them over for Superior Court. But they got suspended sentences and were brought right back home. And then one other time, I had another case where I was ordered to pick up a defendant. And this happened on a July 4th, mind you, when everybody is out there and I'm looking for this person, no policeman. You're appointed to serve the papers. So I go out there and I find this man. And I tell him, here, you're under arrest with this. You come with me? Sure. Why not? So we go up to the jail. I said, tomorrow, we're going to have to ship you out. But that night, it started to snow. And we had a little oil stove. And here, after I locked my prisoner in, I have got to go out and find a guard. Do guard hire. Well, I found one. And then, it was a little chilly in there, in the old jail, so I proceeded to light the oil stove. But all this time, I knew there was something wrong with it, but I just couldn't figure it out. What in the world is wrong? I know there's something wrong, but I couldn't figure it. Well, anyway, the darn carburetor wouldn't work, so I took it apart, cleaned it all out, took the water out, put it back together. I'd learned to do that, living up here, you know. So I lit it. Then whatever was wrong finally came out. The room started to fill with smoke. And did you know someone that was mean enough to pull the darn flue out of that jail cell? I knew there was something wrong, but I couldn't figure it until that darn stove started to smoke inside. So there's no way you can turn a oil heat off. So what we had to do was remove that darn stove and put
you
it out.
You were a prisoner.
Yeah, I unlocked the cell. I said, come on, Wesley, you're going to have to help me. And he
and you had to take the stove out.
Right. And then make him wait until we did find one. And,
Sadie, as a principle of justice, now you've shown here that you have a problem. Somebody commits something that is defined as a crime in our books. But actually, it's generally a man that is pretty good-natured. Many times, I shouldn't say generally, because crime is a serious business and there are hostile people. But when a village incident arises, it's somebody that is known in the village and generally he is a socially acceptable citizen. But he commits an infraction of the law that is on the books. But maybe it's a one-time thing. What do you do? What do you think? What do you feel as a person dealing with cases like this? What do you think? This is a matter of philosophy.
All right. It isn't the easiest thing to sit on a bench where you know the people in the community. Mm-hmm. But an offender, the first offender I'm lenient with, and I take it upon myself, and take all the time in the world, where it might have been a 10-minute case, I make it half hour, so that they may be fully aware of what the law is about, and that next time they do something knowingly, I would not be so lenient. Then I would read the statutes, and upon conviction, what they could get. You know, it's there. But in advising them, the seriousness of the charges, like for instance, if a man goes out and destroys in his drunkenness, and he's charged with malicious destruction of personal property, That's a very serious offense. It's a felony. If it's anything over $100, $150. Well, he comes in, I arraign, and I know this person, and I know he's been a good person, but it's the liquor that made him do it. But the law says that you cannot use that as an excuse. I explain fully the things that could happen to him. And the preliminary examination, I usually strongly urge that they get a lawyer to have someone that has studied law to help them and not to talk in my presence because we're on record. Anything that they could, if I let them talk, could be used against them in a court of law. And they know me, you know. But even though I advise and I charge to them, they feel it's unfair. They'll automatically talk whether I advise them of their rights or not. And right there, if they blurt it out, then I have no choice, you know. If they admit, I cannot accept their plea, but fully advise them that they're entitled to a lawyer in the full proceedings of the case. It's only fair. You know, a plea can be damaging if they feel that they didn't do it, and yet there's somebody, if I know they're being influenced into pleading guilty for some offense that they, these plea bargains the lawyers have or something. You know, I'm not too much for that.
No, I don't think that brings justice.
Well, they do it sometimes, too, when they leave it up to me. Now, if it would have to go to a higher court, with you and Mrs. Niehoff, if he pled guilty knowing the man, what would you give him? You know, they'll probe me, and it'll be the district attorney and the public defender after they plea bargained for a guilty plea. Or if I say I won't state any type of punishment, but leave it to another judge who might be able to decide it. But Van Humason is assigned to this area. He's been a lawyer for many, many years, and he knows the native people. And he trusts me. He can even leave me with a hanging jury and to decide and let him know. You know, those types. But I don't really want that anymore. I've had other judges that come up here and leave me with that decision because I know the people well. And it's unfair for me, and it's really unfair to the defendant. It wears me out. It's up here. Knowing the people, you know.
You know,
but if they leave me the decision on the verdict of the jury and then leave on the plane, well, it's just sometimes they don't even know until they land over in Fairbanks what was the verdict, you know. I don't want that anymore. I don't want any hurried up deal anymore. I want all the time in the world for the defendant to have the chance. And these people that have come up here that are assigned, all they think about is just go one after the other and then leave. You know, that's not justice.
No, it isn't. No.
It's, they leave with me a feeling where, sometimes I just wonder, it makes me feel, what am I here for? I'm trying to protect the rights of these people. And yet, when they do that to me, I've explained fully to Judge Van Humason, I don't think he'll ever leave me with something like that.
A hung jury.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Or a speedy thing that needs a plea bargain, then just 5 minutes in there and plea bargain thing. Steve Klein has been coming up here with the public defender's agencies, and there's various district attorneys that come up here. They're fairly new, and sometimes they're over anxious, but then they're in a hurry. But Steve Klein, I've learned to, you know, really work with, and the people like him. and he's got good reasoning, yet sometimes he can get worked over defending and defending, you know, mm-hmm. to, for good reason to attack.
Do you think that there isn't any kind of an inherent conflict with what is Anglo-Western law, the American law, shall we say, the common law practice that has come into existence today, with the old traditional customs of the Eskimo? Do you think this has, this in itself has brought about any conflicts?
The American way of punishment is more lenient than our old original Aboriginal.
Is that right?
Right. They were very, very strict and severe. Even death penalties.
I know death penalties were imposed.
I find that American law is more lenient, you know, their way of handling, than our old tradition.
Now, in the old tradition, what sort of thing... Now, for example, property. Was property respected particularly if a person mm-hmm. damaged property? He could be...
Stealing was considered a disgrace, and a person could be removed out of a community. This record? Oh, this is the district court. You'll have to get your another number. Okay? Yeah, bye. I'm gonna water hole. But here, overall, the punishments that used to come in, a life for life, the same thing, mm-hmm. like a life imprisonment or electrocution, mm-hmm. a slow death, or removing a person completely out of a community, never to return, with disgrace. You know, those types of punishments, they're the most severe punishments that you can ever be separated from your family, or your whole family moved out of a community.
And because, of course, it could mean death to a yeah. man's family, too, mm-hmm. if we're not able to join another community.
Right. Oh, I tell you, there are all various types of punishment that I've known that are handed down.
Is that right?
And people who lied constantly were yes. marked.
Is that so?
Right. Marked.
Is that so? Not a librette. This would be like
a mark.
Like a fish hook.
Mm-hmm. Maybe even a scar, a little
shape.
Slit.
At the side of the mouth, on either
but
side.
But a scar left.
A scar made on either side of the mouth. Yes, that's so. That meant his mm-hmm. mouth doesn't speak straight, mm-hmm. sort of thing. He's a liar. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, there, if you talk to some of the old, well, we don't have too many.
Not too many left.
Left to tell these types of things. But I used to learn them from Dad, you know, because he'd lived up here with the people. And his word were always to me, never shun mm-hmm. the teachings of your ancestors. Mm-hmm. Respect them, mm-hmm. all of us, because he lived with the natives for so long.
What other things? Lying, then, was considered a very bad thing.
Stealing.
Lying and stealing.
And adultery.
Is that right?
Wow.
Is that so?
Right. And then, too, in those days, there were arranged marriages.
Yes.
They were not suitable marriages at times.
Yes.
And if a couple agreed, exchanging wives.
Yes.
That was no sin.
Yes.
But to envy.
I understand the difference. Yes, yeah. There's a difference between adultery and wife exchange.
Right.
Or mate exchange.
Right.
Whatever. Yes. One is by agreement and the other one is by dishonesty.
Right. Well, I've experienced, even in my time, at my birth, I was promised to a young man. And I've always held it true until I got rejected, you know, the tradition. And today, you know, gosh, these arranged marriages are the worst trouble. Deals today?
Not in the court sense.
Not in the court sense, no. But there's no love involved.
Yes.
It's just that the parents agreed, you get married, you know. And they never fought against it.
Does it still exist today?
No.
No.
No more.
That went out.
That is no more. I talk to these young people when they have their, you know, courtship.
Yes.
And if a parent comes to me objecting, I don't think my daughter should marry that man or my son should marry that girl. All right. I'll tell you like my dad told me. A young man came to ask my dad for my hand one time. And he told this young man, he said, have you talked to my daughter? He said, no, not in that sense, but I feel like I'd like to marry your daughter. Well, young man, I'm afraid I cannot answer you that. You will have to talk to my daughter, and if she agrees, all right, you'll be accepted. If you get rejected, I said, I'm not going to sleep with you. She's going to have to.
Yes.
So I said, that's out. So usually, that brings a point.
Yes.
Give the couple a chance to work.
Yes.
And they do. Yeah, I do. I do marriage counseling.
Well, I'll say you've done a little bit of everything.
Yeah. Well, it's up to...